Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 29th. And regular listeners know I'm no grammarian, but I know you love to talk about language. You care about proper grammar. You care about self-improvement. Did you know that you could use grammar to improve your life? Improving my grammar is one of the things on my list of things to do this year, so I am thrilled and a bit intimidated to welcome in our guest this hour, who is the author of the new book, Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. We'll find out this hour how grammar can restore the ego, how we can take ownership, how we can use grammar for freedom, for belonging, for mindfulness. Plus, I'm sure our guest can answer your questions about grammar and respond to your grammar pet peeves. Please be kind. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Let me welcome our guest. Lawrence Weinstein is the director of the Expository Writing Center and is an assistant professor of English at Bentley College. He taught writing at Harvard and co-founded Harvard's Writing Center. His most recent book is Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So good grammar is good for us.
It is. My hope in having written Grammar for the Soul is that my readers would stop thinking of grammar as a chore to attend to and begin to see it as an array of means available to us to reinvigorate and somewhat remake ourselves.
Yeah, you even compare grammar to a gym. Talk about that.
Right. Hmm. I think it includes all sorts of means for us to enlarge ourselves, to improve morale, but also to foster attributes we care about. Maybe the simplest example of all to say in a minute involves the coordinate conjunction but.
Mm-hmm.
The English-speaking world requires nothing of us when it comes to but that the clause before but and the clause after but both be true, unless we're writing fiction. Well, that leaves to us quite a bit of power, because the clause after but receives what linguists call end focus or emphasis. It's the part that's salient, important, we're meant to take away with us from the sentence. And yet millions of people, with that power in their hands, habitually, unconsciously, put the bad news about themselves after the but, where it does the most damage.
Oh.
They could say, I beat my own best time at the 100-yard dash today. What they tend to say, I should say, is, I beat my own best time at the 100-yard dash today, but I still came in fourth. Rather than
the other way around.
Right. I came in fourth today, but I beat my own best time, which suggests a whole different trajectory, a whole different future.
Why do you think we do that? The former.
Yeah. Hmm. I'm not sure. It may be a feature of evolution that in some ways it helps us to be mindful of our deficiencies. But in fact, it can be demoralizing to dwell on those deficiencies.
And doing it the other way around, you say, is more than just sentence structure. It really can improve our attitude?
It can. We get into linguistic habits without being aware what they do to our frames of mind, our levels of confidence, our other qualities. Another example is how we tend to overuse forms of the verb to be. All forms of the verb to be, I am, you are, she is, are terms of definition. They pigeonhole. They tend to render the subject static. And yet when a person could say, I did poorly at writing this report, instead they go straight for that form of the verb to be, am, I am, and say, I'm no good with words, based on the same results, the same experience. Or when they could say, I let that bully intimidate me, instead they go straight to a form of the verb to be and say, I'm just a coward, I guess. The father of the modern study of semantics, Alfred Kortsipsky, went to considerable lengths to show how problematic all uses of the verb to be were, how reductive, how distorting. And some of his disciples went even further and devised a variant of English, which they called E prime, divested of all forms of the verb to be, which they, these disciples of his, actually tried to speak and to write.
Now, Professor Weinstein, I used a form of to be when I welcomed you. I said, I'm thrilled and a bit intimidated to welcome you and to talk to you this hour. Should I have said that differently?
No, I was about to say these disciples of Kortsipsky went too far. Oh. You were putting adjectives at the far end of your form of the verb to be, intimidated, to say, at this moment I am feeling like that. That's not as problematic as putting a noun at the end. I'm a coward. That's a label. That's static.
Well, I'm that too, but I didn't say so.
What I'm saying here is they, these disciples of Kortsipsky, went too far, and yet they had some good intentions. We do overuse to be.
We're going to check the weather forecast and then continue talking with and welcome your calls for Lawrence Weinstein, who is an assistant professor of English at Bentley College. He is the author of the new book, Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. Wonder how you can do that? 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your call in Madison 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 and a half minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 29th. Coming up later today after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is joined by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, Craig Gilbert, and I'm sure they will be talking all things political. Talking, I'm sure, about the Reverend Wright Barack Obama situation. We'll be talking about that as well after 7 o'clock this morning. The Reverend Wright speaking out on his own behalf, but many saying that he is hurting Barack Obama. We'll talk about that after 7, and Kathleen Dunn will also talk about it after 9. Right now, we're talking about grammar and how good grammar is good for us. Grammar for the Soul, the name of our guest's book, How We Can Use Language for Personal Change. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if you'd like to join in with a question or a comment. Our guest is Lawrence Weinstein. He is the director of the Writing Center and professor of English at Bentley College, author of Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. Well, we have some callers coming in, so let me go right to the phones. Ed in West Allis. Hi, you're on the air.
I think the biggest misuse of a word in English right now is hopefully. As in, hopefully the sun will shine tomorrow. Hopefully a Democrat will be elected in November. It has absolutely no sense. In German, Hoffnungslicht has that operation, but in English, it is very ambiguous in terms of the meaning. We can clear it up by saying, I hope, or it is to be hoped, but I think when you listen to the media and to newscasts, you find that this is one area that is constantly misused.
Is it, Professor Weinstein?
Turns out correct grammar is a moving target. the language doesn't remain in one place forever. It's the English language is a vital, organic thing. It keeps changing. Hopefully as an example, to my knowledge, the word hopefully came into our lexicon through John Kennedy, who used it in the way Ed describes. And that rankled many people. Now it's common fare. When that use of the word, that meaning of the word, Kennedy's meaning, is common for us. And since it's common, since it is common usage, it gains entry to the language proper. It's not the grammarians who make up our rules. It's the grammarians who describe the current state of things out there and codify them, but only in a temporary way, to say, as of now, at this time, for a while, we seem to be using hopefully as follows. I actually devote one chapter of Grammar for the Soul to the subject of compromise, how grammar gives us an occasion to enlarge our capacity for compromise, to accept change as it happens, incorporate it, but with some selectivity, not incorporate just anything, not incorporate a usage that diminishes clarity, for instance.
Yeah. You are resisting, though, the trend toward using they, how do I say that correctly?
Yes.
And not making they singular.
That's right. That's my prime example in the chapter on compromise. We know why we now, more and more of us, say they when we mean he or she. The practice had been always to say he. To say a person who has undergone EMT training at Wisconsin knows what he is doing. But we became conscious that making he the default position
was sexist.
Say again?
Was sexist.
Exactly. And yet it disturbs many of us to have to revert to the plural when we mean a singular. So I list a number of ways around that.
I'll tell you, it just to avoid making it plural is one way to get around it, right? Making your sentence plural, not just saying a pilot, but the pilots.
Right. That's a good way. Mm-hmm. That's a good way. Occasionally you can say he or she, or you can establish a practice within your writing where you alternate, sometimes say he, sometimes say she. But my larger point in the chapter is this kind of thing gives us practice as people with compromise. It's another way in which grammar affords us the opportunity to grow, actually, mm-hmm. to grow in our capacity as people.
Thanks, Ed, for the call. Bob in Adams County is with us now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a construction in a sentence that I'd like to know the name of it. In the sentence, the plane having taken off, comma, the passengers relaxed. What do you call that introductory word group? I know it's not just a participial phrase.
Right.
Is that a nominative absolute?
That's beyond me.
I'm trying to remember, and I can't.
Okay.
You know, my book is not a work of scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
To gain entry to this book, a grammatical move simply had to demonstrate to me that it made a difference in how I felt or acted. To that extent, it's a highly autobiographical, introspective book. A friend of mine said Grammar for the Soul should be subtitled A Grammatical Memoir.
Mm.
I am no more an expert in linguistics, certainly, than Strunken White or Lynn Truss. Mine is a generalist's book. I regard myself as a lay thinker. My essays may not have the value of Montaigne's, but I like to think I stand in his line as a person writing honestly, or trying to, about what it means to be human, fully human or humane. I don't apologize for that, but it pays to know. I did know the technical name for the phrase that your caller just recited. Can't bring it back at the moment.
Yeah, no, and that's all right. I wanted to talk a little bit about the comma that Bob put in that sentence, because you make the comment, for the right person, that mere featherweight, a comma, can alter the course of a day. So how can a comma alter the course of a day?
With a comma, we can practice showing care. We can practice being mindful that we have a listener, a reader, and that our acts have consequences for what goes on in that other person's mind. A favorite example of mine, actually, since writing the book, there's a sign on the Massachusetts Turnpike with just three words on it, no punctuation. The words are, plows, use caution. What am I to make of that? If I'm to imagine a period after the plows, then I'm being told, plows, there are snow plows out on the road today.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, use caution. But if I'm to imagine a comma after the word plows, then I get plows as a noun of address. This is an address to the drivers of plows. Plows, use caution. Remember, there are drivers out here on the turnpike with you. And if, in fact, there is to be no punctuation, it reads, plows use caution.
Right.
It's a reassurance to the drivers not to worry. You can count on the drivers of plows to use caution, which is the opposite of the first meaning. That's an example. If we were in the habit of thinking that we are not just social creatures, but anything we do has an impact on our fellow human beings, we take care that way, and taking care that way would give us practice being caring. That's one way to answer the question. I actually have quite a bit more to say about commas of different kinds in the books.
We will talk more about commas and punctuation and other elements of grammar after we check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Lawrence Weinstein. He is the director of the Expository Writing Center at Bentley College, an assistant professor of English there. He also taught writing at Harvard, co-founded Harvard's Writing Center. We are talking with him about his most recent book, Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. We welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine at 6:36 on this Tuesday, April the 29th. Talking with Lawrence Weinstein, author of Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change, welcoming your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about how grammar is good for us, how we can use active verbs, we can use proper punctuation, we can structure our sentences differently, and alter our mindset and alter the course of a day. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Mary and Nina is our next caller. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. Thanks for the program. Mm. It's a wonderful program.
Well, thanks for calling.
Well, you're welcome. Mm. I just have a comment. I recently graduated with a degree in philosophy, and of course, in philosophy, you write a lot of papers. And at one point, one of my professors said he wanted to take a moment to talk to us about punctuation, especially commas. And he noted that when we use punctuation incorrectly in our papers, it was beginning to cause him physical pain. As a misplaced comma would cause an immediate head jerk. And he said his neck was beginning to get very stiff. So it really had a good effect, though, and it made us think about how we were using punctuation. And I just thought it was a very funny story.
That is funny. Hundreds of years ago, there was an expression, breaking Priscian's head. Priscian was a famous grammarian of around 500 A.D., and people would say that when writers or speakers committed egregious errors, they were causing him, Priscian, the ghost of Priscian, that pain, breaking his head. I need to add, however, perfect grammatical correctness among students is by no means always a good sign. I was recently rereading a book by John Trimble, who teaches English at the University of Texas, Austin, where he recounts how a student came to him and confessed that in her first semester at UT, she had written only very short sentences. Why? She didn't want to have to use a comma. She'd been marked down for comma errors in the lower grades. Mm. She didn't want that to persist at the college level. But how much complexity of thought can you achieve without recourse to a comma? And I've known hundreds of students like her, whom the arcane rules of grammar have intimidated, and who now play it safe. Too safe in their writing, too safe for their own good in terms of intellectual development. I once wrote an essay on those students' behalf entitled Grammar, What Big Teeth You Have. I care about grammar, obviously, and not just for the traditional reasons. That's why I wrote Grammar for the Soul. But it behooves us teachers and other adults not to wield grammar like a stick. Before we become too exercised about a punctuation error, we should be sure there's something going on down there on the page worth punctuating. That's all I'd add to Mary's comment. But
in the book, I'm looking for it now. But you're saying in essence, there's this rule: you need whatever three things to put the comma in, but. You're advocating, in a way, break the rules sometimes.
Yes, I am. Mm. I am. There are times when it makes more sense to break the rule than to follow it. I try to give a few examples in a chapter I call anomalous commas, and I even stand up for the occasional sentence fragment, not to be used indiscriminately. But again, my angle here is personal development. This is not just about grammar. Mm-hmm. In life, we shouldn't be enslaved to rules. We should be attuned to the possibility of the need to break a rule to better serve others or ourselves in the moment at hand. And I'm saying grammar provides us one arena in which to enlarge that capacity.
One of the examples on the book cover, tell me what's wrong with this. A job applicant sends this letter. What a great pleasure it was to meet you today, !
Right. This overuse of intensifiers, words like extremely, marks like the exclamation point, italics, it both reflects a lack of trust. This is about trust, mm-hmm. and I discuss this in my chapter on trust. It both reflects a lack of trust, and it perpetuates that same lack. If the writer would abstain from intensifiers, use fewer exclamation marks, fewer words like a very, he or she would discover they're not needed. And that discovery would not be just a linguistic discovery. It would tend to enlarge that person's trust generally, trust in others. That's my point there.
Mm. Let's take another call. Mark in Whitewater. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment on the use of negative versus positive statements. Mm-hmm. One of my friends who's a philosopher once told me, don't imagine a blue butterfly. And what was the first thing I did? I imagined a blue butterfly.
Uh-huh.
The practical use of this, I was thinking, is how often do we hear people say, don't do this, don't do that, and immediately it's planted in our head whatever it is we're not supposed to do. So I was wondering if you could talk about maybe the use of statements that I guess are positive, where they don't mention what we're not supposed to do, but instead kind of offer an alternative. I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
Do you follow that?
Yeah. That even if we issue a prohibition of some kind, just in naming the act prohibited, we have gotten our listener to envision the act where he or she may never even have envisioned it before. That's a fine point, and one I haven't contemplated. Your listeners, Joy, are helping me to write my sequel.
There we go. You know, I imagined a blue butterfly as soon as he said that. How about you?
Exactly. Yeah. I did, too.
But, you know, I don't know if it'd be any different. If he said, imagine a blue butterfly, I would, and don't imagine a blue butterfly, I probably would. Yeah.
Right.
Terry, in an email from Milwaukee, this program is interesting. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I just this month got my 12-year chip. Sober 12 years. I am blessed. At meetings, I often speak of how important self-talk can be. It can set the tone and reinforce behavior, both good and bad. This program raises self-talk to a whole new level, and you have him thinking. Most often we hear, I didn't really understand what he was writing. Here comes the but, and the but is never good. I think he was reacting to your talk about saying something negative after the but.
Okay.
But I don't talk about, how this is, what you're saying is the same as, self-talk.
I think I'm talking here about the talk we address to others and self-talk. I'm glad this has come up. Whatever we say to others is in our own hearing, and to that extent, it is self-talk. And then there's talk others don't hear that we do just in our heads. And I'm concerned with both. I actually refer to Alcoholics Anonymous in one chapter of the book because their 12-step plan includes such a fascinating combination of active voice propositions and passive voice. And in my view, there's a place for both. And that's certainly, that's not just about interactive talk. That's about the talk inside the head as well. I can give you an example. I'm a great believer in use of the active voice. In fact, writers in English have campaigned against the passive for more than a century. I better say what the active voice is. The active is our most direct, straightforward form of speech. We name the person or thing performing the act, and we put that person's name up front in subject position. We say, my friend threw me a party. As soon as we step away from the active voice, we start getting sentences like, there was a party for me, or in the passive voice, a party was arranged. And the doer of the deed, the person who performed the act of throwing the party, disappears, becomes invisible, or in the lesser case, gets named, but only as an afterthought in a prepositional phrase. Well, as I was saying, writers have campaigned against the passive for a very long time. Most famously, George Orwell in his essay Politics in the English Language, where he set forth a rule never to use the passive if you could use the active. His concern was accountability, especially in government. If we don't name the person taking the act, we don't know whom to hold responsible. We don't want the White House press secretary saying a decision in the passive voice, saying a decision has been reached to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
We want that person naming the decision maker. And that's one good argument for use of the active voice.
Got it. We have to check weather, and then we'll continue our conversation with Lawrence Weinstein, author of Grammar for the Soul. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 7 o'clock, we'll talk with a guest about Reverend Wright speaking out, defending himself, and maybe hurting Barack Obama. That's coming up after 7 o'clock. We're talking about language this hour, grammar in particular, and how using language can be good for us and can change us. Our guest is the author of the book Grammar for the Soul, Lawrence Weinstein, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talking about how grammar can restore our ego, make us feel better, how we can take ownership, how we can use grammar for freedom, for belonging, for mindfulness, and more. And Sophia in Waukesha is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I would like to ask the guest, what does he think about the future generation writing skills using text messaging and quoting websites in their papers? I remember when in grad school we weren't allowed to even quote the websites when it started. And now I see it all over the papers of my students, other students, and it's just unbelievable. Text messaging bringing a new language, a new sentence structure
for generation to come.
What do you think?
Yeah, talk about changing the rules, Professor Weinstein.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's a lot to say about that. Mm-hmm. The change that I find myself contemplating most is the disappearance of capitalization in email. I'm struck that as the years pass, I get more and more email that dispenses with uppercase letters. Sometimes that feels just right to me. I was exchanging messages with a theater director down in Dallas who was directing the premiere of a play I wrote. Hardly a capital to be found in his email. But that felt right. I didn't expect it to feel right. It did, because we were together in the middle of a work in progress. And this lent to the endeavor the unfinished look that was appropriate. Other times, this dispensing with capitalization seems to me just like affectation. And in fact, it's one of the things I find myself mulling now as I think about a sequel to the book. Of course, there's more to say about email, but that's the main thing I find mm-hmm. myself contemplating.
Next, we go to Mark in Shorewood. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. You mentioned Lynn Truss, and she was on this show with Joy a couple years ago.
Yeah, some time ago.
Mm-hmm. When she was doing her book tour on Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. And my question is, does it bother you, in the last few years, the amount of dashes there are in, especially in the newspaper, but in magazines and the New Yorker, I see dashes where there should be either colons, semicolons, or commas. And it's they're just lazy, is my argument. My second question, I'll go off the air, is the number of transitive verbs have entered the language, which bothers me. Like accessorizing, prioritizing, morphing. Morphing has nothing to do with morphology. And so those are my two questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Too many dashes?
Right. Well, I'm probably a greater fan of the dash than your listener. I devote one of my chapters. I think the title is Emily Dickinson's Dashes.
Mm-hmm.
Her early editors were so dismayed by them, they actually excised them before publishing her work.
Yeah. So why do you like dashes?
They are another expressive means available to us. I want to keep our repertoire of means of expression rich. On your listener's other question about new words entering our lexicon, like accessorizing, this is maybe the most common way verbs in particular enter the lexicon. They are nouns turned into verbs, and we don't track that. We forget where verbs come from. Even our word hide, H-I-D-E, hide, we think that's such an elemental verb, but it came from the noun, an animal hide that could be used to conceal.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that. This is how the language operates, grows. And perhaps sometimes we go too far that way. I'm not sure. I don't want the process to stop, though.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned, I'm looking at my notes for this program, and while I don't write a script, which is obvious, I do write some notes and some questions, and I'm looking at what I write, and I have dot, dot, dot a lot. Talk about that. It's meant for me to pause here. When I write down a question, I'll write dot 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 in between something for me to pause.
Right.
What do you think of those dot dot dot?
I like to see, not in all kinds of text, not in all kinds of published text, certainly, but I like to see holes. They keep me on my. They keep me on my toes, as it were. They remind me to be receptive when the time comes to listen for a new idea, to stay fresh if I can. I get at that in my book, in a chapter I call Triple Spacing. I refer back to the eighth grade class I took in journalism, where I was told to triple space my stories because they would be edited, and I'd need space to insert new language, to make changes. But I found that look, that open look, positively bracing. It's what said to me, however I chose to put my thought initially, there were infinite other ways of doing it. If I remained open, if I remained attuned and receptive, I'm not sure, Joy, that's what you mean by the ellipsis, by the dots. That would be my use.
Mm-hmm. How about starting sentences with transitions, and, but, so?
There used to be widely promulgated rules never to start a sentence with a conjunction like and or but. They've pretty much gone by the way.
Mm-hmm.
As part of this ongoing change of the language that I refer to, and I'm not particularly worried about that.
Gary in Madison, hi Gary.
Hi Joy, it really is a good program, and your guest sounds just brilliant. I've got a couple things. I've shortened sentences too because I've been afraid of the comma, and I think lost some of the meaning of what I was writing. But one of the things I wanted to ask, I always hear commentators and people saying more importantly today. It seems to me that more important is more correct. I'll hang up and take your comments off the air.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Yeah. If what we mean to modify is a noun, like, let's say, beauty, more important is her beauty, then we need to use an adjective to do the modifying, important. If what we mean to modify is a verb, the adverbial form with ly at the end is the more appropriate. More importantly, Barack Obama explained himself on the subject of race. There, we're modifying this act of Barack Obama's rendered in a verbal way.
I'll have to remember that for my next hour as we are talking about Barack Obama. That gives me a good transition. We're out of time for this hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a delight. Yeah.
Lawrence Weinstein is director of the Expository Writing Center and assistant professor of English at Bentley College. He taught writing at Harvard, co-founded Harvard's Writing Center. We talked with him about his newest book, Grammar for the Soul, Using Language for Personal Change. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing the hour. Thanks to Michelle Kofel for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.